Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. My name is Scott Linden. I'm your host, and I sure appreciate your sticking with us. Great show in store for you this time around. Our guest, Rick Van Etten, the editor emeritus of Gundog Magazine. Lots of great information, has spoken with lots of great people and learned a lot from them. We'll talk about that. Of course, there's a public access tip for all of you folks who like to do it yourself. Got a dog handling tip for you in there in the importance of birds. We'll also have a quiz and a prize, so pay attention. Your name may just come up in this broadcast as well. The Upland Nation is the only podcast that respects your time, gives you the information you want without all the BS, and I promise never to crack a beer on the air. Okay, let's get started then. The first thing I want to do is thank some of the folks who make this whole podcast possible, starting with my good friend Fred Bohm. Fred sent me something a long time ago that's still in my gun cleaning kit. His company is now called Sage and Breaker, and he makes the highest quality gun cleaning products around. They're wrapped quite often in wax, cotton, and leather containers of one sort or another, so they're dressed for the part, heirloom kind of gun cleaning and gun care products. Sage and Breaker.com. 12 new products coming along. Check in regularly. Sign up for their newsletter and you'll be alerted to all of the new gear as it comes on board, and also as the one or two times a year when you can get in on some bargains. It's all at sageandbreaker.com. All right, so joining me from somewhere over in Iowa, I think, Rick, are you there for me?
I am here, yeah, good. Des Moines, Iowa.
You're coming in loud and clear. You're in Des Moines, you said. And that's where you edited the magazine, Gundog Magazine, didn't you? You worked right out of your office there.
Yeah, for quite a few years, I've worked out of my home here in Des Moines. And originally, the magazine was based here in Des Moines, Iowa. I moved out here in the fall of 1996. I realize I'm really dating myself here, but at that time, the magazine was owned by Stover Publishing here in Des Moines, and Stover later sold the books, and the new owners just said, you know, I could continue working right out of my home. So it's really been kind of an ideal situation.
I can relate. I'm doing it right now.
You bet. There's nothing like it.
No, the commute is about 30 seconds, and that's probably
right,
the best part.
Across the hallway.
Well, you know, you edited the magazine for a long time, and in the course of that experience, you probably learned a lot from a lot of folks way more qualified than you and I put together. Is there anything in particular that just jumps out at you when it comes to gun dogs and bird hunting that you really think that everybody ought to etch indelibly on their left forearm so they see it every day?
The thing that immediately comes to mind, and this is something that I would occasionally address on my editorial page, I guess you would call it kind of a simplified philosophy of training, summed up in two words: lighten up. The older I get, I guess you could say maybe I've mellowed, but I realize I had to always remind myself, this should be fun for both you and the dog. And if it isn't fun, then there's probably something, you know, missing. Don't be afraid to cut your dog a little slack. You know, the old cliche, I don't hit every bird I shoot at. If my dog occasionally makes a mistake, you know, I should be willing to forgive him that. So, you know, the real rigid obedience, drilling endlessly, that kind of thing. The older I get, the less I focus on that sort of thing. Try to make it fun for you and your dog.
Boy, I can relate to that. My wife was a competitive horse rider in the dressage world, and she'd come home every night really mad at the world, and I finally reminded her of the same thing. If it ain't fun, quit doing it. And now she's right, turning the tables on me, because Flick, my young dog, is much softer than most of the wire hairs I've had, and she continually reminds me that he's a very soft dog and I should just lighten up a little, like you say. So thanks for reminding us.
Right. Right.
You know, you edited a lot of stories over the years, including many of mine. Thank you, by the way. I appreciate that.
Right. Yeah, always enjoyed working on your stuff.
Thank you. I hope there weren't too many spelling errors.
Actually, it didn't take much work. Your stuff was always very good. So.
Thank you. Glad to help. Of all those stories and all of the information that you have absorbed like a sponge over the years, is there anything that just jumps out at you as something that, you know, that you wouldn't have thought of unless some expert, not me, had brought it up to you? You know, a tip or a technique or a psychology or anything else that we wouldn't probably have heard anywhere else?
Oh, boy. I'm sure there have been. Editing these stories, it was always a labor of love for me, but it was also an educational experience. A lot of these fellas, they had worlds of experience compared to mine. And, very often when I'd edit her stories, I would think, wow, I never thought about it that way. Or I would find myself kind of, always came away feeling like I'd learned something. It kind of relates again to what I said about the lightening up. You know, a lot of times, one of the things that sticks in my mind, and this came up kind of repeatedly, we tend to drill, we repeat a lot in our training exercises, and one of the things that several of my top guys would say is, if your dog isn't doing something correct, not responding to your command or whatever, chances are it's not stubbornness or defiance. It's more like, they don't understand what you want. And the best thing you can do at that point is back up a step or two. Go back to something that the dog does understand, kind of build on their confidence and take it from there. Very likely, if the dog isn't responding the way you want him to, it's because you haven't clearly communicated what it is you want. You need to go back to the basics and kind of lead him through it. I guess that's the thing that kind of always made the biggest impression on me.
Yeah, I've written about that myself. In fact, it is amazing how many times disobedience is not that. It is not understanding the command.
Right, right. And the more you bear down, the more confused the dog becomes. So, you're doing exactly the wrong thing when you try to hammer it home. Instead, you'd be much better served to kind of back off a little bit and try to rebuild the confidence and move forward a little more slowly.
Well, much like you spoke off the air, I'm not a dog trainer, but I play one on TV.
I played one in the pages.
Exactly. But it does lead to a question from one of our listeners, Andy Upwards, who asks, how to be a great bird dog trainer on your own? Can you tell us one skill you would need besides what we've already talked about? And what you've talked about, what if you make mistakes? We've addressed that. But is there a skill in particular? And it could be anything. I'm thinking, my God, I wish I was a better shooter, because when the dog does a great job, I'd really like to reward him. So now I just carry a dead bird all the time. But is there a skill that Andy should have that maybe bubbles to the top for you?
It sounds a little self-serving to say this, but educate yourself. Try to get as much input as you can. If you have the opportunity to work with a pro trainer or more than one, join a training club where you get input from other individuals. Immerse yourself in the whole process. That's the way you learn a lot of the tricks, a lot of the little, the little subtle gestures and so on that maybe, you know, maybe nobody has written them down or put them into a DVD of a training video or whatever, but you work one-on-one with some of these people and just notice how they do things, you know, notice how they handle a dog, notice their tone of voice, that kind of thing. Try to get as much experience with that as you can. Now, you said a kind of a do-it-yourself, one-person thing. I don't want to say it takes a village to develop a bird dog, but it's probably going to require some help from someone besides yourself. You know, you're not going to be able to do it in your backyard. You're going to need to be able to get the dog into the field, exposure to birds. And again, you know, you can achieve that if you join a training club, if you associate with others, you know, who have similar interests.
Yeah, and subscribe to all the magazines. Thank you very much.
Well, sure. That goes without saying.
You know, it's funny. I look at, you know, I spend a lot of time in workshops and seminars, and then I put some on, and thank you all for putting up with mine when you're there. But I figure if I get one thing out of each training day with the club or one bit of useful information, and I came across one just a few days ago. The guy said something like, let the birds teach your dog woe. In other words, you know, use the bird as a training device, if you will. The dog gets a reward. Ultimately, as we all know, the reason the dog works is not for us. It's for the chance to get a bird in his mouth. So, you know, if we use the bird strategically instead of as simply a prop, sometimes, you know, that rang true with me, and I'm actually using it. We're going to talk more about that in a minute. So Andy Upwards and everybody else who's interested, stick around, because that's the handle it feature that will come right after our first break. Anyhow, you know, Rick, you edited Gun Dog Magazine. You saw some great work in the magazine, but ultimately we're all in it for one thing, and that is to go hunting. What is it you love most about bird hunting?
Well, the obvious answer, of course, I do it to watch my dog work. I mean, you know, we used to say the typical gun dog reader, and I think this was probably true of the gun dog editor and most of the writers as well. If we had to choose between leaving our dog at home or our shotgun, we'd leave the gun behind. We're in it to watch the dogs work, to give them, you know, the opportunity to do what they were bred to do. And there's no denying that a dog, you know, a dog in the field, you can see the enjoyment. You know, that's what they're there for. And that's always been an exciting thing for me. You know, I love watching good dogs work. I've always had field bred Irish setters, but the breed really isn't that important to me. I mean, I've, as the editor of Gun Dog, I've had the opportunity to hunt over many different breeds all around the country, and regardless of the breed, you know, a good dog is a good dog, and they're fun, they're exciting to watch, and you know, that's the primary thing for me. That's why I'm a bird hunter, and you know, have kind of let the other types of hunting. Long ago, I deer hunted for a few years, and I grew up hunting small game with my dad. He was a rabbit squirrel hunter, but once I got interested in bird dogs, I mean, it was all about the dogs. That's what I wanted to see.
Ditto. and virtually everybody else who's listening to this podcast and watching my show, you know, I survey my viewers every year, and that is the number one with a bullet answer to the question. On top of all of that, though, you're over in what is becoming yet again, for the probably fourth time in our lives, a pheasant hunting hotbed, Iowa. I presume you're chasing a lot of ringnecks on top of everything else, but if you had to narrow it down to a species of bird, would that be it?
Probably would, and I say that because I've probably hunted more pheasants than anything else. I mean, I've, as I said, and I don't mean this to sound boastful, but the job has afforded me the opportunity to hunt all over the country, everything from sea ducks off the coast of Maine to, you know, some Georgia plantation quail hunts, desert quail in the Southwest, sharp tails in the Dakotas, you know, but I always keep coming back to pheasants because, yeah, as you say, that's the premier game bird where I live, and I do most of my hunting. I mean, when I'm not traveling, I do most of my hunting on public ground right here in Iowa. So that's the bird I pursue. And but it's kind of like what I said about dogs a few minutes ago, breeds of dogs. I mean, you know, my favorite game bird is the one that I'm hunting at the moment. So
that's perfect. I love it, and it's so true. If you had to pick a second place bird, just out of curiosity, because you mentioned some that are, I hate to use the term bucket list, because I think that's a little bit too obsessive and compulsive, but so am I. What else would be on the top, kind of the top one quarter of your list?
Oh, that would undoubtedly be bobwhite quail, because that's really what I grew up hunting. I'm from central Illinois originally, and that was, you know, back when I first started bird hunting, that was still pretty good quail country, and that's what I hunted early on. So they would run a very close second to pheasants in my heart. I mean, I grew up hunting bobs, and so that would be my number two bird.
All right. Well, hold that thought, and then that earlier thought from Andy Upward's question and your answer. We're going to get back into handling your dog and why and what a dog actually does for us. That's right after this very short intermission. Rick, hold on, because your input will be required in just a moment. And that moment is right now. Thank you to Dakota283.com, the guys in the kennel business. I remember walking into the Pheasant Fest, probably 5-6 years ago, seeing these massive blocks of blaze orange in shapes and sizes I hadn't seen for a while. Well, I pulled over and took a look at the display. It was the very first time that Dakota283 had displayed anywhere, and Greg Cronkite gave me the 411 on the 283, which is some pretty rugged dog crates, kennels, and storage gear of various sorts. And just for us, now that they are a sponsor, Dakota283 has made a very special offer for listeners to the podcast. If you go to Dakota283.com and purchase one of their kennels, then number one, they'll give you free shipping, but everybody gets that. Number two, two for the price of one. No, it is a buy one and then get something free. You can either get a forever insert, which is what they call the little divider. So you got a puppy, you don't need to buy a little tiny box and add on to that. You just get a forever insert in your buy one, get one free for the G3 kennel model. You get that forever insert, or you'll get a dine and dash. And I love my dine and dash. It is, sure enough, it is a food bowl and water bowl storage combination that won't tip over, won't spill, always has a couple and a half gallons of water plus your dog's food for the end of the day. It's all at Dakota283.com. Here are the codes. When you go there and you order your G3 kennel, then at the checkout, you will give them this code, LindenFI. That's LindenFI for the forever insert, or LindenDD for dine and dash. They'll ship it all free to you. That's Dakota283.com. Thank you for your support. All right, so there we go. Thank you again for listening. This is the Upland Nation podcast, and that is the cue for our Handle It feature. Rick Van Etten, the editor emeritus of Gundog Magazine. We'll talk more about the emeritus part in a moment as well. But right now, you know, I had this epiphany a few days ago, and you've seen it too. Rick, we talk a lot about why a dog will do what he does for us in the field. First question to you is, do you think he's really working for us, or is he working for himself?
I wish I knew the answer to that. That's something I've pondered quite a few times myself over the years. I guess I would, this is going to sound like a little bit of a dodge here, but I guess I would say it's maybe a kind of a toss-up, a 50-50 deal.
Yeah.
There's no question that, you know, their instincts are just incredible. I mean, to the point of being almost overpowering sometimes. And yet when I have a dog retrieve, you know, make a long retrieve, maybe a difficult retrieve, at the risk of sounding, you know, anthropomorphic here, I can see the pride in their eyes. You know, when they hand up that bird, when they deliver the bird, you can look them in the eye and you can see that they're happy about what they're doing. You know, I mean, it's kind of like they look up at you like, you know, didn't I do a good job here? And, you know, that to me says, yeah, they do. They understand and appreciate the partnership part of it. You know, I think they enjoy working for us. I don't think it's just a matter of them doing, you know, pursuing their own instincts and just letting us tag along. I think they enjoy being part of the team.
Well, you know, it's interesting because until this moment, I hadn't thought about it the way that you just made me think about it. And that is, yeah, I kind of agree with that. Getting back to their basic instincts, I think they do like to work for us, work with us, because ultimately, and this is back to this thing that Brad Higgins, a great trainer I'm learning to really respect these days. Again, he's taught me that that a lot of times the dog, what they really want is they want you to deliver a bird for them. And,
Sure.
if you're the guy who delivers the bird, then they're going to love you. They're going to eat bees for you because you're the guy. And that's how Brad right. kind of has adopted his training strategy, so that if they want, of course, they're called bird dogs for a reason. So if they want a bird, they learn, first off, they can't catch them.
Right.
Then
right.
they learn that you can, and okay. you can provide them. Right. So, you know, to me, in my training at this stage with my young dog, that means every time we have a bird fly in the air and he's steady to wing shot and fall, he's going to get one. We're at right. that point right now. And if I miss, or if there are flyaway birds, they're homers because I have a coop as well, then I'm throwing a dead one for him so that
right.
he always gets one. Have you had similar experience? Are you you know on you understand kind of what I'm getting at there?
Yeah, I do, certainly. And I'd like to put a little bit of a humorous spin on that too. First of all, let me say I agree with what you've just said. Yeah, they're definitely looking for a bird to be falling as a reward. As a follow-up to that, I would add that they also, a seasoned bird dog, one that's got at least a couple of seasons under his belt or under his collar, quickly learns when you should get a bird, but you don't. A couple of years ago, I wrote an editorial column called The Look, and it was talking about the look that your dog gives you when you whiff. You know, when it's a gimme shot, and you miss, and the dog looks at you like, what happened? You know, I think a smart dog quickly realizes, you know, when a bird should be falling, and if you miss for whatever reason, they'll give you that look that says, come on, buddy, you can do better than that.
Okay, I've got a request for everybody listening out there. I probably read it in your magazine or somebody told it to me who stole it from your magazine. There's a great joke about exactly that, and it ends with a dog peeing on the shooter's boot.
I can believe that.
Somebody yeah. out there, if you know that joke, please email it to me, scottlindenoutdoors@gmail.com, because this is as far as I get every time I tell the story, and I can't yeah. get to the good stuff. So yeah. it's so true, isn't it? They got that look for you, and then you feel bad. You know, I remember I took a shoot. You know, I'm left-eyed dominant. I'm colorblind. I got a curved spine. I got a club foot, all this stuff. So I got excuses for shooting poorly. You know, I got enough for three guys. So I went and took a lesson with the father of an Olympic champion many, many years ago, and he made me fill out a form. You fill out a form every time you take a lesson from him, and it asks, why do you want to learn to shoot better? And I said, so the dog won't get mad at me.
That's a good answer.
Yeah. And, you know, it works every once in a while. Yeah. So,
yeah.
You know, it's funny, you know, we talk about dogs working so hard to please us, but really we're working so hard to please them too, aren't we?
We should be. Yeah, we should be.
Yeah. Well, there you go. That's our Handle It segment. Every week we're going to talk about dogs and dog training and dog handling in the field. And Rick, appreciate your feedback there. Let's get back to you and your life. How'd you get into magazine editing? You know, a lot of us think we're writers. So don't get me on that. But you go from writing to magazine editing. Were you in another subject area? How'd that all end up happening?
Well, I'll avoid the tendency to say I was born in a small town. My education was in communications and English, and I spent about 10 years in corporate communications and then got into magazine work. Worked for a publisher in Milwaukee, Wisconsin for several years. And at the same time, I was beginning to do some freelancing. My predecessor at Gundog was a terrific guy named Bob Wilbanks, and I did quite a few articles for him, breed features and some training pieces. And he just basically mentored me into this position. As I say, I was working for another publisher at the time, and when he was getting ready to retire, he contacted me and said, would you like me to put your name forward as my successor? And I was like, geez, twist my arm, you know. So that's kind of how I got into it, and it kind of fell into place from there. As I think I mentioned earlier, you know, I've been a lifelong dog lover. Got my first bird dog when I was sophomore in high school, I believe, and began, you know, really studying them. I mean, reading everything I could get my hands on. So, you know, eventually being given the opportunity to edit Gundog Magazine, I couldn't have hoped for anything more ideal.
Well, you're a lucky guy, and in the course of doing all of that, of course, we were the lucky guys and gals as well who got to read all of the stuff that you brought to our attention in one way or another. You put two bird dog guys in a room and you're bound to get at least three opinions of anything, including the magazine or the particular article or anything else in the subject area. For you, though, editing so many great writers and editing so much incredible content, what was the most enjoyable part of being the editor of Gundog Magazine?
The most enjoyable part, holding a new issue in my hands when it came off the press, there was always that kind of thrill of, you know, opening the issue and looking through it and thinking, you know, a real feeling of satisfaction, of completion, of looking at it and thinking, yeah, you put this together. But I don't want to overemphasize my role. You hit on something just a moment ago. It was really the contributions of the writers and the photographers who made it, you know, the magazine that it was. I mean, I was kind of, steering the ship, I guess, but they did the heavy lifting. I mean, it was their material that really made the magazine. I assembled the pieces, but they were really the backbone of the whole thing. So it was, as I said before, a labor of love, and being able to work with so many fine people, so many fine contributors over the years, read their copy and learn something along the way. And they were a great bunch of people, as you would expect. You know, I mean, they were true sportsmen in every sense of the word, and fine writers for the most part. And it was just truly a pleasure to work with all these folks.
You know, there's a guy who, a good friend of mine many years ago, who used to write a lot for Field and Stream and Outdoor Life, said everybody's got one great magazine story in their head. And they're probably going to sell it to the guy I'm trying to sell my great magazine story to. In fact, everybody does think that they've got a story. And if they do, whether it's for Gundog or anybody else, and now that you're out of it, maybe you can speak a little more freely, what would your advice be to them about honing that into something that other people might want to actually read?
Two things immediately come to mind, and this is the stuff that I looked for. You know, of course, most of the material that appeared in Gundog came from regular contributors, you know, people that we use on a regular basis. But we got a fair number of submissions from people, you know, just from the outside that, as you say, thought they had a great story to tell. The first thing I would say, make sure it's letter perfect. Don't send in something that is sloppy. You know, if you have misspelled words and typos all over it, that's going to jump out at the editor and say, you know, this is too much work. I don't have time to clean this up. Secondly, I would say downplay the sentiment. There's a tendency, especially when people are writing about their favorite bird dog, to kind of go overboard on the sentimental stuff. And unfortunately, that doesn't always play well with readers. A little bit of it is okay, but you have to be careful. You can't go overboard. So, you know, stick to the facts, stick to the descriptions. Don't get too carried away with, you know, all the sentimental stuff.
There's somebody I know in your business or your former business who would go so far as to say, please, no dead dog stories.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, in fact, I'm probably one of the people who would say that too. Everybody has a dead dog story. The sad fact is very few other people want to read them. It takes an exceptional writer to pull off a dead dog story without, as I said before, going overboard on the sentiment.
Hey, let's switch gears.
Less is more.
Yeah, exactly. And let's not even go any deeper into that topic, because then we'll both be weeping, if not outwardly moaning.
Right.
You know, you get to hunt a lot. You've been around the place a little bit here and there. We all have something we won't leave home without when we go on a hunting trip. What's your go-to item that we might not remember?
Oh, boy. You kind of got me with that one, Scott. Can I take the easy way out and say my dog?
Oh yeah, well we've, you know, perhaps.
I wouldn't leave home. Going back to what I said before about having to choose between your gun and your dog.
Amen.
I'd always make sure I would make sure my dog and everything that I needed to take for her. I mean, if I'm going to be hunting away from home for any length of time, you know, fresh water, her food, all of her supplies, any necessary supplies. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. I guess number two on the list would probably be, you know, a cell phone. You know, unfortunately, accidents do happen in the field, you know, and you need to be prepared. A first aid kit for both you and your dog, you know, because again, stuff happens and you need to be ready for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, all good stuff. In fact, that reminds me, years ago I started making a list, and since then many of my viewers and readers over the years have added to it. We call it the ultimate upland checklist. And if you right. just go to my website, scottlindenoutdoors.com, and you'll find it there. It's the only thing not on that list is the semi-truck you need to haul it all. So,
Exactly.
Now, you know, we have talked around all sorts of great issues, but, you know, the one that a guy like you probably is well positioned to talk about that we haven't addressed, and I won't ask you to pick a favorite son or daughter, because I know better than to do that. But, you know, in the world of writers and writing and literature in our subject matter, bird dogs, bird hunting, and that sort of thing, would you have any book recommendations that maybe we hadn't thought about that, you know, I came across one a couple days ago that I had no idea had been out there for 60 years, but there's gotta be one or two that you think are really important for us to know about.
When I first started editing Gundog, our point columnist was a fellow named Charlie Waterman, and that name is probably familiar to a lot of people. I mean, he's been gone for a number of years now, but But he had several books on upland bird hunting and his bird dogs, and I remember one of them. I can't remember which book it was, but he actually dedicated it to his Brittany Kelly, and he said in the dedication, it said he wasn't the best bird dog in the world, but none ever tried harder. I mean, you gotta love a guy who would dedicate his book to the dog, you know. And anything by Charlie Waterman, I don't think you could go wrong with that. You know, some of the classic guys, Corey Ford, George Bird Evans. There for many, many years, I reread Evans' Upland Shooting Life at the beginning of every bird season, just because that was a life I wanted to imitate. You know,
mm-hmm.
I thought that was a great piece of work. Let's see, who else? So, you know, some of the classics, Nash Buckingham, Havilah Babcock. Again, I realize I'm kind of dating myself here, going back to some of those guys. But those are among my favorites. And some of the, you know, some of the more contemporary guys, Stephen Mulock, you know, he's got some great stuff out there.
Great. Well, all good. And Charlie Waterman, yeah, high on my list as well. So, there's two votes and none against. So, you know, if we were to wrap this up with anything in particular, Rick, being who you are and where you've been and what you've done, you want to leave us as fellow bird hunters with any advice, something that perhaps doesn't get said often enough, or maybe you couldn't find room for it in any of your other work. What would you leave us with?
I guess I would, you know, kind of go back to what I said earlier about lighten up on your dog. Remember to have fun. It's not always about a full game bag. You know, enjoy the whole experience. I remember a piece you had in Gun Dog a year or two ago about hunting solo, going out by yourself. And we got a lot of good response to that piece, by the way. A lot of readers really, really enjoyed that. But I remember one of the points you made in that piece was that, you know, when you're out there and it's just you and your dog one-on-one, it really gives you the opportunity to, you know, appreciate and enjoy things that you might not notice when you're hunting in a crowd or with a group of people. And I guess that's the thought I would leave you with. You know, take time to appreciate everything that's around you. Take time to appreciate just the time you're out there with your dog, you know, regardless of whether you see a lot of birds. Just enjoy the experience for what it is.
Can't do better than that. Thank you for the plug, by the way. Tell your successor that I'm a great writer. I appreciate that. But Rick, you know, this is the longest we've ever had a chance to talk, and I'm really grateful for it for any number of reasons. Over the years, I've been grateful that you bought some of my stuff, but more importantly, for what you did for that magazine and for everybody who reads it. Thank you, and I know I'm speaking for everybody else when I thank you. Gundog Magazine, an icon in the field, Rick Van Etten basically took it to the next level when he came on board, and now he is resting on his laurels, hopefully staying out of trouble and going hunting more. Is that your goal for the future?
Yeah, I think future. Right now, I'm enjoying a less structured lifestyle. It's nice to be able to spend as much time out in the field with my dog in the morning without having to worry about getting home to get on the company computer, not having to worry about, you know, magazine deadlines, that sort of thing. A number of people have asked me if I'm going to be starting a new puppy, and the answer is yes, but probably not right away. My current dog, Maddie, is 7 years old, and I want to give her, you know, a good full season this year, where, as I say, I don't have to worry about deadlines or anything like that, spend as much time with her in the field as I can, and then probably next spring I'll start looking around for a successor.
Some of the best advice I got from my veterinarian was, if you're down to one dog, enjoy that dog for a while before you go on and add another one to the string. And it was so right. So,
yeah.
Well, good luck on that. I hope you find all the birds your dog wants you to find, and vice versa. Rick Van Etten, the editor emeritus of Gundog Magazine, friend and colleague and all-around good guy. Hey, thanks so much for being on the Upland Nation podcast, Rick.
Oh, you bet, Scott. Thank you.
All right. Good day now. Wow, that was something, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. It is one of those chances we have to, you know, kind of pick the brain of somebody who we don't get the chance to talk to. We see their work, but you wonder about the guy himself, and this is a good chance to do that. Speaking of good chances, though, we've got another one coming right up, and that's now. So pay attention, because we're going to talk a little bit about public access in a feature I call This Land is Your Land. You know, if you watch my TV show, by the way, it's called Wing Shooting USA, you know that we hunt a lot on private property, and there's a long story behind that I'll bore you with some other time. But when I'm not hunting on TV, I'm probably on public ground looking for wild birds, and some of that ends up on the show once in a while as well. I'm going to help you out. Seems to be a number one priority of so many of you, finding new places to go that are free or at least easy to get to. The first one on my list today is the Fort Pierre National Grasslands, just south of South Dakota's capital city, Pierre. Yeah, that's how you pronounce it there, Pierre. About 7 miles, and then you're on grasslands, and it runs for another 20 miles south of there and about 10 miles on each side of the highway. It is exactly what you think it is. It is an ocean of grass, and that means great habitat, particularly for sharp-tailed grouse. A few prairie chickens. Every once in a while, I'll shoot one by accident when I'm chasing sharpies. I'm a little colorblind, I told you that. And then every long once in a while, there is also a ringneck pheasant somewhere in a creek bottom. It's an incredible place. You can see your dog run away from, you know, for a day or two. If you stand on a tuna fish can, you can see him run away for a week. That's how big the place is, and it's kind of cool, but you better have a big running dog for this federally managed land. It's beautiful in its own way, very stark, literally. Not much else on there. You'll find a tree here and there. You'll find a pasture once in a while. There's water everywhere. It's got a little bit of everything, but in small quantities, it's mainly got grass. Yeah, there's campgrounds, there's restaurants and hotels and even a laundromat in Pierre, and that's where you'll see me at the end of a trip out there. Lots of access, very little traffic. After the first part of the pheasant season, virtually nobody. The right time to go there is probably sharptail season, which is mid-September. That way you have actually a chance to get close enough to them to shoot, which is also one of the key issues in big country like that. They can see you coming from a mile away, and they will. Sharptails in particular will station themselves on a high spot just so that you can't see them before they see you. Anyway, take a look. The Fort Pierre National Grasslands, it's one of those treasures that we all ought to take good care of, and one way to take good care of it is to go out there and enjoy it. That's our This Land is Your Land feature, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you've got some suggestions for other publicly accessible places that we should talk about, I don't want your secret spot, I don't want your latitude and longitude, but if you've got a general location, a town nearby or something like that, go ahead and communicate with me at scottlindenoutdoors@gmail.com. That's where you'll talk with us. If you've got a question, you've got a suggestion, you got feedback about the podcast, still working out all the bugs. Appreciate your patience on all of that, but it all starts with your input as well. And speaking of your input, coming right up is our pop quiz. And before we get to that, though, I want to remind you that if you want to stock up on anything for this bird season, how about energy for your dog? My dog energy bar, dogenergybar.com is where you find out more about how important fat is for your dog. And if you're looking for fat, well, besides a picture of me, there aren't many better sources. Almost 51% fat and no volume to speak of. And that's the key if you're going to be feeding your dog anything during the day of a hunt. Dogenergybar.com. End of discussion when it comes to your dog and all the important stuff that matters. Now, let's take a look at our pop quiz. Last week's pop quiz, the question was, where was the large Munsterlander breed created? Congratulations to Susan Lubas, who had the answer. Germany, of course, specifically near Munster. No duh, right? Susan, you're taking home, well, you're getting delivered to you a Reactor Sport watch. If you watch the videos, you know, yeah, they shot bullets at them. They shot shotguns at them. They whacked them with hammers and mallets. The Reactor Sport watch, it's the one I wear. When I wear a watch, it's the Reactor. This week, answer the question at scottlindenoutdoors@gmail.com. It is, what shotgun bore is not in gauge? It's not measured in gauge, rather it's measured in caliber. The prize this week for that answer is a Cabela's collapsible dog bowl. Don't leave home without one. Among others, that's one of the things in my vest. All right, well, I hope you enjoyed the podcast. You can always learn more at uplandnation.com. You can listen to other episodes of the podcast. You can ask questions there. And generally learn a whole bunch more about us and what we're doing here. Appreciate your listening. Hope you'll watch Wing Shooting USA as well. And in the meanwhile, be safe. Thanks a lot and goodbye.